Well, hello everybody. Welcome to the second episode of In the Dry Dock. I am your one of your co-hosts, William Wittenbury, and then our other co-host is Wade Waterstreet. And today we'll be talking about early naval warfare, as well as kind of transitioning into the age of sail, really all the stuff that happened before we started to get into steamships, which is actually quite a bit of history to cover, but we're going to have a lot of fun with it. And this week, our ships of the week are the Greek trireme Olympias, which is now a museum ship and is actually one of the only remaining trireme or galley type warships left in the world. It was a replica. And then our other ship of the week is the USS Constitution, which is the oldest floating commissioned warship in the world. It was one of the first six large warships built for the United States Navy and is still actually a commissioned warship in the US Navy. So we'll be hearing about that, as well as some of the more general details about warfare in the age of sail leading up to the 1800s.
Well, thank you, Will. We have, as you can see, we have a lot in store for you tonight, and hopefully we can cover all of that, and hopefully we can take you through why were ships used for war in the first place. I mean, would you say, Will, it's a fair concept that humans have spent most of their history in war?
Unfortunately, I don't think there's ever been a time where there wasn't some sort of conflict going on. And in so many cases, ships were vital to those conflicts because control of sea lanes and control of coasts has often been a deciding factor in conflicts. Going all the way back to, you know, we'll learn about the Greeks versus the Persians today, and how that really was decisive in that conflict going all the way back to the BC period.
And then, of course, the Chinese invention of gunpowder would revolutionize the idea of warfare in general. And of course, this would extend to the seas. And this brought on a whole new level of carnage. But also, you could say that warfare is always a huge amount of carnage in general. But I would also like to take the time, first of all, to apologize to all our listeners that this second episode is coming on so late. Think of it as we had our pilot episode and then it took a while for the next episode to be released, but there were some personal reasons. Obviously, both Will and I have had to move recently. I believe he is back in his original location, but I have since moved from my hometown to St. Louis, Missouri. So River Town, woo! But anyway, this is the area of the steamboat. So I am very excited for a future episode where we may talk about the Mississippi River trade, but that's another story. And Will, are you back in the Midwest or are you still out in California?
I'm out on the West Coast now. So we actually did a cross-country road trip last week to move me out. And that was a lot of fun. We got to see a lot of interesting stuff. Didn't really do anything Navy history related, although I did drive past the USS Batfish, which is a World War II submarine that's now a museum in Muskogee, Oklahoma. We didn't stop, partially because the Batfish was actually damaged in a recent flood and is not open at the moment. But that's pretty much the only Navy history related thing that I ran into, except for I did drive through Cairo, Illinois, which is really at the very bottom of the state, where the Mississippi and Ohio rivers meet. And that was a major ironclad base for the Union Navy during the Civil War. So we got to kind of go through there, and that was interesting. But yeah, that was my Navy history experience.
Yeah, for all of you that don't know, the Midwest right now is going through a major flooding situation all across the states that are counted as the Midwest. It has been a really bad year. There are estimates that less than 50% of our total agricultural crops have gone in. It's really, really bad. And
yes, we saw a lot of the aftermath of that during our trip.
Mm-hmm. I have to say, when I heard about the USS Batfish, I thought it was hilarious because there couldn't possibly be any submarine that would be placed in the middle of the country. You know, I mean, it does sound pretty ridiculous, doesn't it?
Well, and of all the kinds of ships that shouldn't be affected by a flood, you would think that a submarine would be okay, but yeah.
Obviously, it wasn't.
No, so, I think it'll be fine, but they have to do some repairs.
Yes, yes. I'm sure it won't be too bad. I mean, it can't be any worse than the I hope it's not any worse than the shape the SS United States is in, but obviously, since you're not allowed to just walk on there, we will never know. You've gotten to see the U-boat that's in the Museum of Science and Industry, right?
I have. That's a really cool exhibit.
If you ever want to get over your fear of enclosed spaces, claustrophobia, go into a World War II submarine. Yeah,
Yeah,
that'll do it.
especially a foreign one.
You got to respect how small the spaces were in there. And
Yeah,
yeah, it's not
pretty
something
tight.
I would ever want to repeat.
No, there's another submarine that's here in California, which is no longer open to the public, but it used to be. It's a Russian submarine, a Foxtrot class attack submarine called the Scorpion. And what was interesting about that was that most of its stuff was still in working order. The submarine basically defected to the West at the end of the Cold War, and they handed it over intact. And the guy who used to be the chief tour guide was actually the former captain of the submarine. And all the switches and stuff still work. So there are all these signs around saying, don't touch anything. But what was really kind of interesting was they had all these signs inside too saying where the water line was. And as you went through the tour, you realized you were below the water line and it was pretty cramped in there. So, yeah.
Isn't that the one that's docked next to the Queen Mary?
Yep.
Okay, that's what I
It's
thought.
in atrocious condition now, from what I've heard. So it's not open to the public at the moment. I'm not sure what the long-term plans are for it.
So anyway, that's a little update on the two of us. Now we're going to get back into the business of how did naval warfare start? Well, to be honest, it was probably as simple as realizing that you could point your pointy end of the boat towards another and ram. And in all honesty, that's how naval warfare started. There wasn't really the idea of using projectile weapons at first, unlike today, because that's pretty much all we think of, either large caliber naval rifles or missiles or something along those lines, projectile weapons, or at least guided weapons. That wasn't really the case. Until the advent of gunpowder, like Will is going to talk about later, you really, really could not have a naval warship that couldn't ram. That was the idea. You would have a large solid wood, or sometimes bronze, or even iron in some cases, that you would aim on a course, often with rowers instead of using the sails, to collide with another ship, and often this could end in boarding parties on both sides, and it would often end up with both sides sometimes slaughtering each other, or sometimes it would come down to just who killed who first. These were close quarters fights, and they were often really, really nasty. And then there was the case of simply getting there. You would often, now I'm gonna, of course, be talking about the Olympias later. The Mediterranean has very, very distinct ocean currents and also wind patterns, which means that sailing wasn't always an option. So that was why rowing was often considered an option, for warships, because sometimes you couldn't depend on the wind for tactical situations. To be honest, sometimes you just can't go with where the wind takes you.
Yeah, and that did start to change eventually once sailing ships became more advanced. But for a very long time, oar-powered vessels, which were usually referred to as galleys, were the primary offensive weapon in most of these fleets. And actually, the last major battle that was fought entirely by oared vessels like that was the Battle of Lepanto, and that was as late as 1571. So this type of warfare lasted a pretty long time.
As I recall, that was the Ottoman Empire versus the it wasn't the British, was it? I don't
No,
think
so it's
so.
actually it was a multinational coalition. So that happened pretty much in the aftermath of the destruction of Constantinople, and the Ottoman Empire expanded very rapidly in the Mediterranean, and it alarmed a lot of their other European rivals, particularly Venice. And what ended up happening was the Battle of Lepanto was kind of the ultimate engagement in this conflict, and the fleet opposing the Ottomans was called the Holy League, and it was led by Venice and the Spanish Empire. And actually, one of the key weapons that the Holy League had in their forces were six galleasses, which were kind of a hybrid between a galley and a sailing warship. So they still had a full bank of oars, but they also had sails as well. And those were pretty much the decisive weapon in that battle. And most of these galleys were pretty lightly armed by modern day standards. They usually had like five or six cannons just in the nose, and they usually did not have broadside guns. But the galleasses did have broadside guns, and so that kind of led them to be a decisive weapon in that conflict. And by 1588, which was, you know, less than 20 years later, the Battle of the Spanish Armada was fought almost entirely by sailing ships. I think the Spanish Armada did have a few galleasses in it, but it was predominantly between sailing warships.
Now, building on what Will said, the Ottoman Empire was centered around what we would call Southeastern Europe, and also what we would call the Middle East or the Levant today, and also North Africa. It was an extremely large empire and largely built its reputation on the harbor city of Constantinople, renamed Istanbul. And this was, from what we know about the city and its history, was a fabulous port, and it still is considered one of the key strategic cities in the area. In fact, the Russians have tried to make deals with the modern day state of Turkey for use of the Bosphorus Strait, which Istanbul is a key player in. So,
yeah.
For those of you that are confused, the geography of the region, you have the Mediterranean Sea, and then you have the Black Sea, and the Strait of Bosphorus is right in between the two. The city of Istanbul, right there. So.
And the reason why the Russians are so concerned about it is because the Russian Black Sea fleet is obviously in the Black Sea, but they want to be able to move their major heavy units between the Black Sea fleet and their other forces. They also have the Baltic fleet, the Northern fleet, and the Pacific fleet. And the Turkish government actually has a policy that they do not allow aircraft carriers to go through the Bosphorus Strait. So the way that the Russians got around this is their one and only aircraft carrier that they currently have in commission, the Admiral Kuznetsov, is actually officially referred to as an aircraft-capable cruiser. And so basically they just don't call it an aircraft carrier, so they get around the rule, which is pretty funny. But to this day, the Bosphorus and the Dardanelles, which is the other approach from the Mediterranean side, are extremely strategic locations.
I'm just going to say, you call it a goose, but if it's a duck, it's a duck.
Yeah.
Just saying. But anyway, that's... just so you all know, even though we will have a basic topic for all of these episodes, we are not against bouncing around to different subjects as they come. So make sure you keep an open mind as to what we're going to be talking about. So to kind of say what was the reason that naval warfare was even touched on with the Greeks in the first place. First thing you need to know is that the Greeks have, of course, the Greek mainland, where we usually see all the action, but the Greeks also have thousands of islands in what's called the Aegean Sea, which is really, you could say, a sublet of the Mediterranean Sea. And these islands all had their own distinct cultures, but they were all, you could say, Greek in some way. And there was a strong maritime tradition in between all of them, but also the Greek city-states, when you think of the city-states, you're thinking Philippi, Athens, Sparta, you're thinking a bunch of others, but usually we think of Sparta and Athens. Now, when we're talking about city-states, we're talking about essentially cities that are countries unto themselves. And this doesn't bode very well when a country, when an empire comes knocking on your door, such as the Persian Empire. Will, would you mind giving a little intro into what the Persian Empire was?
Yeah, well, there are actually several different Persian empires over the course of history. And the one that was dealing with the Greeks was very powerful in its time. And the Persian Empire was expanding very quickly in that time period. And obviously they came up against the Greeks. And the Persian forces were led by the Emperor Xerxes, and they had a very powerful fleet. But there were several key advantages that the Greeks managed to have. The Greeks had actually been preparing pretty well for a naval conflict. Pericles, who was a major leader in Athens, had seen to it that the Athenian Navy built up a powerful fleet of trireme warships. And a trireme is a galley that has three different banks of oars. And Themistocles was the Greek admiral that was in charge of the Greek forces. And the particular version of the Persian Empire involved in this case was the Achaemenid Empire, which was one of the earlier ones. But the key advantage that the Greeks had in this case was that all of their ships were rowed by volunteers, whereas most of the Persian ships were rowed by galley slaves who were actually coerced into rowing. And so the morale on the Greek ships was much higher than it was on the Persian ships.
You have to remember that this was one of the few times in Greek history that most of the city-states were able to unite against a common enemy. This was almost unheard of in Greek history up to this point. And to be honest, it was somewhat of a miracle that they were able to get their, to use a World War II term, shit in the sock fast enough to actually make a defense at an opportune moment. Now, of course, we all know about the Battle of the 300. Yes, that actually did happen, but I doubt it was as dramatic as Hollywood would like you to believe. But
that did actually happen basically immediately before the Battle of Salamis. And so, you know, the Greek city-states were kind of on the ropes at this point because they just lost the Battle of Thermopylae. And the other problem was, although, like as I mentioned, they had a few advantages with better crew morale, they were pretty outnumbered. So most ancient sources say that the Greek fleet included no more than 378 ships, and the Persian fleet had possibly over 1,000. So they were heavily outnumbered.
Yes. Could you imagine facing an army that big and you're that outnumbered? Yeah, you'd be pretty scared and you'd probably be pretty demoralized, even if you knew that you had the better training and the better reason to fight for. You know, it'll always be the question in warfare, which is the better motivator for soldiers, defense or conquest, defense or conquest. Personally, I come on the side of saying that defense is a better motivator when it comes down to it. But some people really, really thrive off of that ability to conquer. I mean, Alexander the Great practically bathed in it, you could say. But that's a story for another time. But anyway, jumping over from the idea of the general history of the Battle of Salamis and also the Greek victories that would come against the Persians eventually, yes, they did end up winning and driving the Persians back. So, spoiler alert, that's what happened. But anyway, I'm going to jump into my ship of the week right now. As I mentioned before, I'm going to be talking about the Olympias, which is also a commissioned warship, believe it or not. It is actually owned by the modern Hellenic Navy. And that's what the Greeks have chosen to use as, you could say, the adjective when describing something that is Greek, Hellenic. This goes back, you could say, all the way back to the era of Alexander the Great. It's nothing new. It's something they've done for a long time. But anyway, the Olympias was first thought of back in the early 80s, and it was the brainchild of several individuals, but the three that were, you could say, most responsible for it was a classics teacher by the name of Charles Willink, and then also a donor known as Frank Welsh, and then also was chaired by a individual known as Boris Rankov. I'm pretty sure he was Russian, but But anyway, like Will said, the Olympias was a trireme, which means that it was an oared vessel, but also in this case, the Olympias also had sailing capability. So it wasn't simply just an oared vessel. Now, part of the reason that the Olympias was built was actually to prove a point, much like the Polynesian example that you gave last episode, Will. This vessel was actually built to prove two performance measures that were described by the Greek historian Thucydides. That's the best I can do. But he described Greek triremes as being capable of, one, going 9 knots under oar power.
Whoa, that's pretty impressive.
Yeah, 9 knots. And then also that it would be able to perform a 180-degree turn, so turning around completely, in 1 minute. And also in an arc no wider than 2.5 ship lengths. Now, the Olympias was built to be 121 feet long, or 36.9 meters, and had a beam of 18 feet 1 inch, or 5.5 meters, and it had a draft of only 1.25 meters, or just over 4 feet. So it was actually, by modern standards, it was a really small ship. But even then, can you imagine moving, trying to force something to move, completely turn around, that's 121 feet long in less than a circle of about 500 feet? I can hardly imagine it. But
yeah, that's really impressive.
When the Olympias was taken to sea in 1987, when it was actually commissioned, and then 1990, 1992, and 1994, and 1987, every single time it proved that it could do this speed, and it could also do this maneuverability factor. And maneuverability was an extremely important factor in naval warfare when your main weapon was a bronze ram at the front of the ship. So you can imagine that these were bold claims made by the Greeks in their contemporary time. But it was even more amazing when it was proven to be true. Now, the Olympias has a few differences that should be mentioned about its design as opposed to the original ships that would have been built by the Greeks way back, let's say 300 BC. The key difference is that the hull itself was actually made of Douglas fir and Virginia oak, which are two trees that the Greeks would have never even heard of at this point. Now, they probably had similar woods that they could use, but this is something that could not, maybe it couldn't be found, or it couldn't be found in large enough quantities, or there might have been protected forests that they couldn't touch. There's a whole mess of reasons that they couldn't have used the proper woods for this. Now, the other thing, and this is actually, this has been worrying this ship too strenuously, is that the original rigging, all the rigging that would hold the sailing equipment up, would be made of hemp. Now, for those of you that don't know, hemp is a plant material that is very, very versatile, actually. But the problem is that it's in the family of cannabis, so it's got a really bad reputation and all that. You know, it looks like a marijuana plant, all that stuff. But beyond that, so all the rigging for original Hellenic Navy ships was made of hemp. Now, they couldn't use that back in the 80s. So they had to use actually steel rigging as opposed to steel cables as opposed to that. Now, the problem is that a wood ship has the ability to bend quite a bit. It will actually twist on itself, going over waves and also going in the troughs of waves and what have you. Now, the problem is that unlike hemp, which will snap and then just fall flat, when steel rigging breaks, it snaps back and can take someone's head off. So, unfortunately, the sea trials of the Olympias has not included any heavy weather examples. So unfortunately, they'll never know whether they could maintain this speed in rough weather, or they would have had to back off because they just can't build it exactly right. So that's the Olympias in general. Right now, it is actually on exhibit in dry dock. It is actually not floating anymore. So it's mostly used for events in the Hellenic Navy, So it's not much of a museum ship anymore, but I imagine if you asked really nice, I bet the Greeks would let you. That's just how they are. Believe me, I used to have a neighbor that was from Greece. He would feed you like crazy if you just said I'm hungry. So I'm just gonna say that's probably the best example of what the Greek people are like. So anyway, I'm gonna turn it over to you, Will. Now you're gonna take us about 2,000 years from what I'm talking about to one of the most famous examples of sailing vessels probably in the world. Take it away, Will.
Sure. So we're going to jump ahead now to the late 1700s and talk about the development of warfare in the classical age of sail. And this is what you think of when you think of Lord Nelson and, fictional characters like Hornblower and Jack Aubrey, or if you're a little campier, Pirates of the Caribbean. But anyway, there's a lot to cover with that. And obviously, we're not going to do all of that right now. We're just going to scratch the surface. So, classical naval warfare tactics started to develop during the war, a battle with the Spanish Armada in 1588, as we previously mentioned, and that's a whole other story in and of itself. And then they continued to develop after that, particularly during the Anglo-Dutch Wars, where the British really started to perfect the concept of what's called a line of battle. And that's essentially where two lines of ships would sail past each other and fire at each other. And for a couple hundred years, that became pretty much the standard way that naval battles would be fought. And the main type of ship that would be used for this came to be known as a line of battle ship or a ship of the line. And these came in multiple different sizes, and they got progressively larger as time went on. But eventually, the tactics started to change a little bit. And in particular, an admiral who was very influential and very innovative in these tactics was Lord Nelson. And he led many different British fleet actions during the Napoleonic Wars against France. And his most famous action was the Battle of Trafalgar, which occurred in 1805. And what he did was he actually, instead of sailing his numerically inferior fleet past the Franco-Spanish fleet that he was fighting, he actually headed directly for them and cut the Franco-Spanish line into three pieces by sailing his ships through the Franco-Spanish line. And this was an early example of what we call crossing the T. And that's where you sail your ships in front of another fleet so that you can bring all of your broadside guns to bear and they can't fire back at you with anything except their forward-facing guns. And that was a tactic that was important well into the 20th century. The Battle of Surigao Strait, which happened in 1944, was kind of one of the last to use that tactic.
Let's not forget the Battle of the Denmark Strait, where it did not go so well for the Allies.
Yeah,
In
exactly. Yeah. So anyway, that was kind of the background for what was happening in terms of tactics. And leading into our ship of the week, a ship type that developed kind of alongside this ship of the line or line of battleship was called a frigate. And that started to first develop at the end of the 1600s and really came into its own in the 1700s. And it had a different purpose than the line of battleship. So instead of standing there in a line and shooting at the other ships, the frigates were essentially scouts. And they were also called the eyes of the fleet. And so they would be used to go find enemy fleets and report on their locations. But they also served a purpose similar to a modern cruiser, where what they would do is they would go on extended solo missions, sometimes to attack enemy merchant ships, sometimes for exploration purposes. They were often used on long distance trips to kind of show the flag and things like that. And the British eventually came up with a very detailed system for what they called rating the capabilities of their ships. And so it went from first rate all the way down to, I think, 10th or 11th rate. And a first rate ship would be like the HMS Victory, which was Nelson's flagship. And that's actually the oldest commissioned warship in the world. It's not the oldest floating commissioned warship in the world. That's our ship of the week because it's actually in a dry dock now. But that was a 100 gun battleship with three decks of cannons. By comparison, frigates were usually sixth rates or fifth rates. And they usually had one main deck of guns and sometimes some guns on the upper deck. And the British kind of had a classic formula where their frigates, typically by the end of the 1700s and going into the 1800s, they usually carried 38 guns. That was kind of the standard size. And the standard gun type carried on British frigates was the 18-pounder gun. And that meant it was a cannon that would fire an 18-pound cannonball. So anyway, the British had a enormous fleet of these things. But during the Revolutionary War, when the United States was trying to gain independence, We had a few of them ourselves. And most people don't realize this, but the United States Navy actually hasn't been around for the entire history of the United States. During the Revolutionary War, the Navy was actually called the Continental Navy. And the Continental Navy's main force included 13 frigates, which were built during the Revolutionary War. And actually, most of them got picked off one by one by the British. But after the Revolutionary War ended, we only had one major ship that was left in commission within a few years of the end of the Revolution, and that was the frigate USS Alliance. And the Alliance actually was involved in the Battle of Flamborough Head, which is where the Bonhomme Richard, which is a famous ship from the Revolutionary War, defeated a British ship called the Serapis. And the Bonhomme Richard was led by John Paul Jones. And his famous quote was, I have not yet begun to fight from that battle. Anyway, the Alliance was there, but the Alliance ended up being sold off, I think, in the mid-1780s. And when that happened, suddenly the United States no longer had a Navy. And this
Side note here. After the surrender at Yorktown by the British, the United States unfortunately had a pretty rocky beginning. We were massively in debt. Actually, you could say the states were in debt because the original Articles of Confederation essentially said that the individual states each had their own currency. They all had their own bills to pay. It was a pretty, pretty bad financial situation to begin with. So the idea of selling a ship off to maybe make some money actually makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, and trying to support a Navy was expensive, you know, even back then, and it just wasn't a priority, especially because there wasn't really a strong central federal government. A lot of individual states actually had their own navies. So, for example, there was the Massachusetts State Navy, there was the Virginia State Navy, things like that. But this started to become a problem in the late 1780s and early 1790s, because although the United States did not have a Navy, we did have merchant ships. And a lot of our merchant ships were going to the Mediterranean, and they were getting attacked by what are called the Barbary pirates. And those were pirates from several city states, including Tunis, Tripoli, and Algiers primarily, which were nominally under the control of the Ottoman Empire, but they were pretty much independent. They had their own local rulers, and they were causing all kinds of problems attacking merchant ships in the Mediterranean. And so for a while, we actually try to deal with the situation by paying them off. We would pay them tribute to not attack our ships, but that would only last so long, and then they would start again. And eventually this became a real public relations problem for the government. And by this point, we had written the Constitution. We had a stronger federal government. George Washington was the president. And the rallying cry among the public became millions for defense, but not a cent for tribute. And so what ended up happening was they organized the United States Navy to meet this threat from these Barbary pirates. But of course, the United States Navy had no ships, and so they had to build some. And so what ended up happening was Congress authorized the construction of 6 frigates to begin the United States Navy. And these 6 frigates were the Constitution, which is our ship of the week, the Constellation, the United States, the President, the Chesapeake, and the Congress. But we were also looking ahead to the future, and we still had kind of an uneasy relationship with Great Britain, and we realized we could only afford to build a small fleet, so we wanted to make sure that each ship that we built was individually superior to its foreign counterparts. And this is actually a policy remarkably similar to what the Japanese ended up pursuing during World War II, but that's another story. And so I mentioned earlier that a British frigate of the era was usually a 38-gun ship mounting 18-pounder guns. The Constitution was classified as a large frigate, and she was nominally rated to carry 44 guns, but in practice, she actually carried 56 guns usually. And her guns were a mixture of cannons and carronades. So a carronade is actually a shorter but fatter version of a cannon that fired a heavier projectile but at a shorter range. And so on the Constitution's main gun deck, she carried 24-pounder guns, which were also called long toms. That's what they were nicknamed. And the 24-pounder guns had longer range than the British 18-pounder gun and had greater hitting power. And then on her upper deck, she carried 32-pounder carronades. So she was much more heavily armed than a similar British ship of the era. And that the British standard had pretty much been adopted by other navies as well. And so this was considered fairly radical at the time. The Constitution's designer was a gentleman named Joshua Humphreys, and he designed three of the six frigates. So the other two frigates that were kind of in the quote-unquote Constitution class were the United States and the President. There were several other features that these ships had that made them different from other frigates at the time, and one of them was the type of wood that was used. The Constitution and her sister ships used live oak, which was harvested from Georgia, and that was a much denser and stronger wood than the type that was used by foreign ships, and it was much more difficult for cannonballs to penetrate. So, you know, we didn't really have armor, so to speak, at that time, but the Constitution was closer to kind of an armored design in the sense that it had much stronger wood. And they also used what was called diagonal cross bracing, which was essentially an X-shaped girder arrangement on the interior of the ship. And that helps strengthen the vessel against hogging and sagging, which are two different kinds of deformities that can happen to a ship over its lifespan. So anyway, so the Constitution was laid down in 1794, and she was completed in 1797. And fairly early on, these ships saw action. In the late 1790s, we actually fought what was called the Quasi-War with France. That was over some French privateering that was happening. And privateering is when ships are given what's called a letter of marque, which allows them to legally attack ships of another country. That was happening. They were attacking U.S. ships in the Caribbean. So we sent our early frigates down there. The Constitution didn't actually score any victories during the Quasi-War against other frigates. I think it did capture a privateer. But one of the other ships, the USS Constellation, did actually score a couple of major victories over the French. The Constellation was a smaller ship than the Constitution. She had 36 guns, but she was significantly faster. Her nickname was the Yankee Racehorse, and she could actually sail at 17 knots, which was pretty impressive. So anyway, in 1805, kind of, or I think 1803, right on the same time that the Napoleonic Wars were happening, we had had it with the Barbary pirates. And so the Constitution went over to the Mediterranean and engaged the Barbary pirates. She bombarded the city of Tripoli. And there were several other engagements that happened in what was called the Tripolitan War. So if you ever listen to the U.S. Marine Corps hymn, they mention the shores of Tripoli. That's what they're talking about. And that was really the first major conflict for the United States Navy. And the Constitution was the fleet flagship under Commodore Edward Preble. After that, pretty much successfully concluded, the Constitution came back to the U.S., and a few years later, the War of 1812 broke out, and this broke out over an issue called impressment, and this is kind of a nuanced issue, so there's several different sides to the story, but the British Navy was enormous at this time. I think they had over 600 warships, and trying to get all of them manned was difficult, and they were fighting, obviously, the Napoleonic War against France. And they were running low on men. And so they would actually stop and board U.S. merchant ships and essentially kidnap sailors off of them and force them to work on British ships. And this was a policy called impressment. And this really bothered a lot of Americans. And there were also territorial disputes dealing with Canada. And there were several things going on. But really what kind of set off the War of 1812 was a British warship called the Leopard attacked the Chesapeake, one of the six frigates, and actually impressed sailors off of the Chesapeake after firing at it. And this was kind of the last straw for a lot of Americans that, you know, a U.S. Navy warship had been boarded and attacked by a British Navy warship. So several other things happened, and eventually the war was on, and it was not a great situation for the U.S., partially because Thomas Jefferson was actually not a big Navy advocate, and he had had most of the large ships in the U.S. Navy laid up in what's called mothballs, and had instead devoted Navy funding to building several, I think a couple hundred, essentially tiny rowboats that were armed with a single cannon, which were ostensibly for shore defense, but they were pretty useless. So the bottom line with all of this was that at the beginning of the War of 1812, the Royal Navy had over 600 warships and the United States had 17. So it was definitely a David versus Goliath situation, although the vast majority of the British fleet was engaged against the French. So what ended up happening, there were several early engagements in the war, and the Constitution managed to escape the British blockade, and then she had to run away from a British fleet that consisted of several warships, including a line of battleship and several frigates. But because the water was extremely calm and there was still air, there was no wind, all the ships were what was called becalmed, where they were basically stuck. And what the Constitution did was they sent out their boats ahead of the ship, they would drop the anchor, way out in front of the ship, and then they would reel it in. But because the anchor was still stuck on the bottom, the ship would be dragged toward the anchor. And this was called kedge anchoring. And so they used this tactic to get away from the British. And then a couple of days later, one of the British frigates called the Guerriere managed to catch up with the Constitution, and the fight was on. But it was actually over pretty quickly. And I want to say it was under an hour that this battle lasted. And the Constitution managed to pretty much completely destroy the Guerriere. It wasn't immediately sunk, but it was so severely damaged that it wasn't worth keeping. And so they ended up sinking it. And during this battle, one of the American sailors, the story goes, noticed that the British 18-pound cannonballs were bouncing off of the live oak hulls of the Constitution. And he apparently yelled out, "Huzzah, she's made of iron." And that's how the Constitution got her nickname, Old Ironsides. And shortly after this, the Constitution got into another battle with another British frigate called the Java. And the Java was a slightly larger ship than the Guerriere, so it was supposedly a better match for the Constitution. But that one was also over pretty quickly and ended up pretty much the same way. Around the same time, the United States, which was the Constitution's other sister ship, defeated and captured a British frigate called the Macedonian and brought her home to the United States, where she joined the U.S. fleet. So there were kind of three major victories in a row early on in the war, and there were also some smaller ship actions between sloops that had similar results. And so the British fleet quickly learned that the Constitution and her two sister ships were not to be messed with. And so British frigates actually had standing orders that if they were alone and they saw the Constitution or either of her sister ships, they were not to engage and were instead, you know, supposed to keep their distance. What ended up happening was the British kind of got their act together, and one of their ships was the HMS Shannon, which was really a crack ship. She was considered to be the best trained vessel in the Royal Navy with the best gunnery. She was blockading the Chesapeake, which was one of the six frigates, but the Chesapeake had always kind of been considered to be an unlucky ship. She was actually designed by somebody else other than Joshua Humphreys and had a smaller armament. She carried 38 guns, so she was more like a normal British frigate. And unfortunately, she had a new crew at that time, and the crew had only been together for about 2 weeks, whereas Captain Dacre's crew on the Shannon had been together for several years and were really well trained. So Captain Dacre's challenged Captain Lawrence of the Chesapeake to a duel, and between the ships, not personally, and that didn't go so well. The Chesapeake was actually captured by the Shannon. Lawrence was killed. But his last words were, "Don't give up the ship." And that became kind of a rallying cry for the U.S. Navy during the rest of the War of 1812. What ended up happening was in 1813 and 1814, the Napoleonic Wars were starting to die down and more ships were available to the British. So they really tightened the blockade on the United States coast. And so most of the U.S. ships were unable to escape out into open water. But there were a couple of exceptions. Unfortunately, the president, the Constitution's sister ship, was actually run down and captured by a British frigate called the Endymion. I may have mispronounced that, after the president ran aground on a sandbar, which was really kind of a bummer for her crew. And but the Constitution managed to get in one more major victory, and that happened very close to the end of the War of 1812. She had a new captain, Charles Stewart, and the Constitution found herself facing two British warships, the Cyane and the Levant. The Cyane was a 32-gun frigate, and the Levant was a sloop of war. So both of them were individually inferior to the Constitution, but together they presented a major threat. The Constitution actually managed to do a complex series of maneuvers where she would sail forward and then change the trim of her sails so she would sail backward, and she went back and forth to attack both ships and ended up capturing both of them. I think the Levant ended up getting recaptured later by the British fleet, but both of them were initially captured by the Constitution. And so the Constitution, to this day, is considered one of the all-time champions of the U.S. fleet in terms of number of enemy ships captured or sunk. And she was undefeated. The Constitution was never defeated in a battle by an enemy warship. And she remained in commission the entire time. After the War of 1812, she became less important to the fleet because we had much larger ships. We actually started building some ships of the line during the War of 1812, but they were only finished after the War of 1812, the first one of which was the Independence. And we also built several more frigates to a modified version of the Constitution's design. I think we had something like 9 or 12 of those. The British also figured out that the large frigate design exemplified by the Constitution was a good idea, and so they built several of their own. I think their first was the Newcastle, and then they also did what was called a razee. And a razee is when you take a ship of the line and you actually cut it down so that it basically turns into a large frigate. So the HMS Saturn was an early example of doing that. Anyway, all of this happened. The Constitution did serve in the Civil War, but pretty much as a barracks ship. She didn't see a whole lot of active duty combat during the Civil War. And by the turn of the century, she was actually in pretty bad shape. But she ended up getting restored. She did a major tour of the United States in 1931. She actually came to Los Angeles in 1931 under her own power and has since remained in commission as a sail training ship and kind of as a heritage exercise for the United States. And she every year in the 4th of July, she will sail out into Boston Harbor under her own power and kind of cruise around, which is pretty cool. She does fire her guns every day as a salute in the morning. I'm sure the neighbors love that. And one thing that's kind of cool about the Constitution is kind of an interesting statistic now is that of all of the warships in the present day U.S. Navy, the Constitution is the only one that has actually sunk another ship, which is kind of wild. Obviously, that wasn't the case back when we still had some World War II era ships in commission. But now that we don't, that's the case. And so if ships were alive, I could kind of picture the Constitution lecturing other ships about, you know, when I was your age kind of stuff. So it's a really interesting thing to see. She is a museum. If you're ever in Boston, I highly recommend that you go see her. One thing that's kind of interesting is, you know, because she is a wooden warship, a lot of the wood has had to be replaced over the years. So as of the moment, the current estimate is that about 15% of the ship is still original. She just went through a major renovation and rehabilitation a couple years ago. And a lot of the copper on the bottom, though, especially on the inside, is still original. And when I visited the Constitution a few years ago, I was actually able to go below decks and touch one of the early copper rivets that was actually made by Paul Revere himself, which is pretty cool.
Wow. So,
yeah, so that's neat. As for the other six frigates, they all had various fates. The Congress was scrapped. The Chesapeake was lost to the British. She stayed in British service for a few years before I think she ended up getting scrapped too. The President was also captured by the British. The United States had a very unfortunate fate. She was at the Gosport Navy Yard in 1861 when the Confederates took over Virginia, and the Union Army essentially abandoned the Gosport Navy Yard in the Norfolk area to the Confederates, even though the Union forces in the area were actually numerically superior. They didn't realize that. And there were several major U.S. warships there, and they all got put to the torch. And so the largest U.S. ship of the line ever built, the USS Pennsylvania, which had 140 guns, was burned. The United States was burned. And another steam-powered frigate called the Merrimack was burned. And she ended up getting kind of rebuilt by the Confederates into another warship called the CSS Virginia, which we will talk about at another time. But anyway, and then the Constellation, the last of the six frigates besides the Constitution, was broken up. And depending on who you ask, there's a lot of different interpretations of what happened here. Her wood was used to build a new ship, also called the Constellation, which was a sloop of war. That ship served in the Civil War and is now a museum in Baltimore. For a while, some people thought that the Constellation in Baltimore was the Constellation, the original one of the six frigates that had been refitted into that. And what didn't help that problem was in the 1890s, some people in a kind of misguided attempt at historical preservation decided to renovate the Constellation into its quote unquote original 1797 configuration. So they modified it to look like the original Constellation. And so that led some people to think that it actually was the original Constellation. The general consensus now is that it's not the same ship, but it used a lot of the wood from the old ship. So part of the old ship lives on in that ship. And so that's now a museum in Baltimore, and you can visit that too. In terms of other sailing warships that you can visit, the British have several, obviously the Victory, and then I think there's at least two British frigates that are on display. One of them is the HMS Trincomalee, which is a Leta-class frigate, and that was kind of their standard 38-gun ship type, so you can visit that and see what a real British frigate from the era looked like. And then the HMS Unicorn is another frigate, which is also on display. So there's a few of these kinds of ships around. There's also been some replicas. So the HMS Surprise was actually originally built as the Rose, and that was a replica of a 28-gun frigate, which is kind of the smaller end of the frigate spectrum. And that ship was used in the movie Master and Commander when they renamed her the HMS Surprise for that movie, and that's now on display in San Diego. So there's a few ships like that. There's also some smaller ones. Another War of 1812 ship is the USS Niagara, which was a brig that was the flagship of the U.S. fleet at the Battle of Lake Erie. And she's kind of like the Constellation in that no one's really sure if she's a replica or the original. But that's on display, I think, in Buffalo. So there's a few of these ships around that you can see. So going real quick, going back to just kind of warfare in the age of sail, the U.S. Navy, you know, became more powerful after the War of 1812, but it was never as powerful as the Royal Navy. That didn't come until much later. And the age of sail kind of lasted pretty much into the 1820s, 1830s, and then steamships started to come in. And actually, the first steam-powered warship was a U.S. warship called the Demologos, which we built during the War of 1812. It was designed by Robert Fulton, who also designed the Clermont, which was the first steamship in the U.S. And the Demologos had some kind of weird features. It had a paddle. It was a catamaran that had a paddle wheel in the middle, and it had underwater firing 32-pounder guns. It was never actually used in combat, but it was definitely an important experimental ship. And so by the era of the Civil War in the 1860s, almost all new warships that were built had steam power. And most of the older sailing ships had started to be phased out. Although in the Civil War, the Union Navy still had a lot of sail-powered warships. So really the kind of classical period of warfare in the age of sail lasts from around 1650 to about 1840. So it's almost a 200-year period. And then, you know, if you go a little bit earlier than that, then you run into more kind of galleon, Spanish Armada type stuff. So there's quite a bit of history there. Obviously, it's impossible to cover all of it. We could do a whole nother episode just on Nelson and all the big battles that happened in the Napoleonic Wars.
So anyway, I can't thank you enough, Will. That was absolutely amazing. But I can hear the water coming into the dry dock. We are out of time for this episode. I can't thank you enough, listeners out there, for making this possible. And if you want to check out our earlier episode, if you're newer, we're getting onto more platforms, but your best bet right now is Spotify. I know I'm asking a lot, but I'm going to make sure that our host Anchor gets us on Google Podcasts as well as iTunes Podcasts. We're going to be to more providers soon, I promise. But for now, I'm your captain, and Will and I will say goodbye.
Bye, everybody.